From WHYY in Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane, sitting in for Terry Gross. Woodstock 94 is underway, and on today's archive edition of Fresh Air, we hear from some of the performers at the original Woodstock. We feature a 1987 interview with singer Joan Baez, an interview from last year with Levon Helm of the band. Later, we'll hear from two-thirds of the rock group Crosby, Stills, and Nash. David Crosby and Graham Nash tell us how they met and how they started playing music together. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new film, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. Both Democrats and Republicans are saying today that a version of the anti-crime bill can still be passed, even though the House has rejected the measure on a procedural vote. The legislation has critics who don't like its ban on assault-type weapons and those who don't like its increased death penalty provisions. House Republican Whip Newt Gingrich said today that the bill can be, as he put it, strengthened and then voted on. After meeting with President Clinton today, the cabinet members emerged, vowing to fight hard for the bill and accusing special interests, including the gun lobby, of trying to kill it. The president called today for police to give him more help in convincing Congress to accept the measure. He spoke to the National Association of Police Organizations in Minneapolis. A federal appeals court has blocked Shannon Faulkner from becoming the first woman cadet at the Citadel, a military school in South Carolina. Barry Myers of member station WLTR reports.
Ms. Faulkner had been scheduled to enter the Corps of Cadets at the state military school on Monday. The stay was granted by the 4th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals at the school's request. Last month, U.S. District Judge Weston Houck found the school's all-male policy was unconstitutional. In a dissenting opinion, Judge Kenneth Hall says by all rights, Ms. Faulkner should be preparing to enter her second full year of military instruction and training as a full-fledged member of the Corps of Cadets. Hall says South Carolina is denying its daughters the education that is rightfully theirs under the Constitution. One of Faulkner's attorneys, Bob Black, says the order means Faulkner will continue as a day student outside the cadet force. Black says she'll remain a civilian until next year. The appeals court says it will hear arguments during its December term. For National Public Radio, I'm Barry Myers in Columbia, South Carolina.
A spokesman says UN forces in Bosnia are speeding up their standby withdrawal plan. They could pull out if President Clinton decides to lift the arms embargo and let the Bosnian government buy weapons. The BBC's Barnaby Mason has this report.
President Clinton's move is a response to increasing pressure in the American Congress to help the Bosnian Muslims. It's also intended to convince the Bosnian Serbs to accept the peace plan by threatening them with a wider war. But the prospect of their enemies acquiring heavy weapons might lead the Serbs to strike quickly in a new offensive while they still held the advantage. A resumption of the shelling of Sarajevo and other towns would be a probable consequence. Mr. Clinton's deadline is a high-risk move that increases the temptation for Bosnian Serb hardliners to take that course. Lifting the arms embargo would make the withdrawal of UN forces from Bosnia almost inevitable. The soldiers might leave as early as November.
Barnaby Mason reporting. On Wall Street, the Dow Jones Industrial Average is up about 19.5 points at 3770.32 in heavy trading. In over-the-counter trading, the Nasdaq Composite Index is up nearly 3 points. This is NPR. The judge in the O.J. Simpson case has refused to give reporters a look at the gruesome photographs of the murder victims. Judge Lance Ito ruled on a request by the news media to see the photos of the bloody bodies of Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman. Those pictures had been shown to witnesses during a preliminary hearing. NPR's Renee Montaigne reports from Los Angeles.
Lawyers representing the media argued earlier this week that they didn't intend to broadcast or publish the photos, but that reporters needed to get a good look at the pictures in order to better report the evidence and interpret witness testimony about the bodies. Judge Ito refused because, quote, graphic sensationalistic descriptions of the pictures, quote, would paint mental images in the minds of potential jurors that would prejudice the right to a fair trial to both parties. Both the defense and the prosecution had strongly objected to the release of the photographs. The judge is allowing reporters to view some other photos of evidence, including pictures of a knit cap, a shoe print, and blood-stained gloves, but he also ruled that the bulky manila envelope dramatically surrendered by the defense during the preliminary hearing will remain a mystery, turning down media requests to make public secret meetings about that mysterious envelope. In Los Angeles, I'm Renee Montaigne.
A 250,000 lightweight summer skirts made in India are being taken off the U.S. market in the government's largest clothing recall ever. The Consumer Product Safety Commission says the skirts made of rayon catch fire easily and burn faster than a newspaper. They're long and full, made of two layers. The top layer is very sheer. Commission Chairman Ann Brown says consumers must stop wearing these skirts. She says consumers who don't know if their rayon skirt is from India is part of the recall should take it back to the store to find out. The two sides in the baseball strike are talking again in New York. It's their first meeting since Wednesday. The players' walkout began last night. I'm Barbara Campbell in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscowane. This year may mark the 25th anniversary of Woodstock, but it's also the 35th anniversary of Joan Baez's debut at the 1959 Newport Folk Festival. She was just 18. She quickly emerged as one of the leading artists in the folk revival of the 60s. Baez began her career singing traditional ballads, as we'll hear in this recording of Silver Dagger.
Don't sing love songs, you'll wake my mother. She's sleeping here, right by my side.
Baez moved on to sing more contemporary songs, and she began championing the then little-known singer, Bob Dylan. She recorded his songs and featured him at her concerts. Her repertoire became more political as she took a more active role in the civil rights and anti-war movements of the 60s. To this day, she continues mixing music and politics. Her 1992 album, Play Me Backwards, received much critical acclaim and was nominated for a Grammy. Terry Gross spoke with Joan Baez back in 1987 when her autobiography was published.
Your repertoire when you started was filled with very, very serious and very tragic traditional folk ballads. And I know that some people in your audiences would actually laugh. You mentioned this in your book because the songs were just so serious and so sad.
Endlessly sad.
What attracted you to the material?
I think I identified with all the sort of the tragedy and so forth. And late teens, mid-teens, I was wandering around, you know, wanting to have something wonderful happen, like fall in love, and all these songs were unrequited love songs. And it was just probably one way of working out adolescence. But also, they were very, very beautiful. They were long, and they were long stories, and I'd sometimes weep while I was learning them. And then the fact was that one night, sort of an awakening to me, people got the giggles in the coffee shop because it was just, there were too many sad songs in a row, and so I had to learn how to lighten up just a teensy bit.
Was that hard to do?
Well, probably for me at the beginning, yeah. I mean, people didn't know I had a sense of humor until about a week ago, you know, that I was so serious on the stage. And then, see, I got serious about politics, and I really was, and I think I was afraid that if I cracked one joke from the stage, I'd think, aha, I knew she wasn't really serious about the politics. And so I was pretty serious for a long time.
You've referred to your Madonna virgin image when you were starting out. What kind of image was that?
Well, you know, there was an essence of purity about all the songs that I chose and the songs that attracted me. There was an essence of purity about me, in fact. I didn't take drugs. When I was labeled a virgin, I still was one. I mean, I didn't last terribly long, but and the things that attracted me in life really grew out of a Quaker background and concerns with other people struggling and with suffering, and that came down from two grandfather ministers and to my father, who had rejected defense work and lots of money, to remain a Quaker and a teacher and keep his, you know, his beliefs and his integrity and so on. So there was a certain element of at least attempting to be true to ourselves in our family. And then that whole basis was the foundation for my social activism and politics all through my life.
Well, how consciously did you cultivate your image, which had such power over your listeners? By that, I mean, you know, your long hair, the kinds of colorful clothes that you'd wear.
Well, the funny thing is people established an image probably from Newport and a couple of the early pictures. And then it doesn't matter what you do, they still keep that image. I remember a woman talking to me one time. I had so much makeup on my eyes I could hardly open and close them, because that was very beatnik, is to wear gobs of stuff on your eyes but no lipstick. And the word was out that Baez didn't wear makeup. And here's this interviewer saying, and it's true, you don't wear any makeup. And I was pointing to these clots on my eyelashes. And I said, but I have makeup on. She just kept saying, that's just fascinating at your age that you reject makeup. So, you know, people see what they're ready to see in a way also.
When did you start moving your repertoire toward more contemporary and political songs?
Well, I think my courtship with ballads took maybe 2 years of my life in Cambridge in 59-60. And then as soon as I had any relationship at all with the civil rights movement, and I started that in 61, I started picking up the songs that would really be relevant in those situations. So I would start with the early songs, the spirituals, and those things could connect me with that movement. And then there was this odd situation of me being an interpretist of song. Never occurred to me to write. I probably couldn't have in those days anyway, because I was convinced I couldn't. And so that when Phil Oakes wrote There But For Fortune, and then Dylan began writing those real gems that he gave us, that's when some of my thoughts and feelings and activism connected with the music, 63, 64, 65.
You've, during your career, sung a lot of songs by Bob Dylan, who was your good friend and for a short time your lover. How did you meet?
Meet Bob. Somebody said, you've got to come to Greenwich Village. There's this incredible guy who writes music and et cetera, et cetera. And I had been told by a number of people the same thing, that this incredible guy was in the village. So I went to see him, and he was incredible. I mean, I was very impressed. He was this funny little guy with his guitar. The night I saw him, he was making up songs. He sang the song to Woody, and then he was just making up words, which just, I was in total awe of that, to just stand there and ad-lib and make up music. And then he was dragged over to the table to meet the Madonna, and it was all very awkward because, you know, I felt like some aging dowager at that point. He seemed so young. And I didn't work with him for, I think, maybe a year or so after that. We just met him that night.
Well, you were more established than he was at the time, and you took him on an American tour that you were doing and used to introduce him.
Yeah, I'd introduce him, my audience, I mean, you know, they're trained into absolute silence to listen to the Madonna singer nubile folk songs, and on would come this little scruff ball, and he would sing, and his voice, you know, they were not prepared for that, and then sometimes they would boo. And I'd shake my little finger at them like a schoolmarm and say, now you listen to this boy, he's a genius. And so they'd be quiet and obedient. And then before very long, maybe a verse or two, they figure out that in fact it was something quite astonishing going on with the songs he was writing.
Well, that really helped him get known. And then shortly thereafter, he went on an English tour and took you with him, except he didn't share the spotlight with you the way you had shared it with him.
That's true. I would talk about that in a grander sense in general. Somebody who came into an identity at age 18, as I said, you know, and I thought it was pretty terrific to be the Madonna, and got lots and lots of attention, and learned to sort of survive on that. And one of the things that happened was I couldn't stand having the show stolen from me. I was very ungraceful about that, and I simply couldn't believe that that was happening. About Bob's gracelessness, people can make their own assumptions why he did what he did, but the difficulty for me was my own reaction to that I kept going back to it and didn't sort of, you know, didn't use my head or didn't have one in that situation.
Do you still sing songs by him?
Sure, yeah. They're marvelous. They're the best. They're the best that anybody wrote, in my opinion, for the things that we needed and the things that we did in the 60s. They are really a gold mine.
That was Joan Baez speaking with Terry Gross. We'll be back with more from our Woodstock archives, an interview with Levon Helm of the band, after a short break. This is Fresh Air. Another group that worked with Bob Dylan was The Band. They were his touring band in 1965 and 66 when Dylan first went electric. After that difficult tour in the summer of 1967, the musicians who would become The Band holed up with Bob Dylan in a big pink house near Woodstock, where they wrote and recorded a bunch of songs on home recording equipment.
If your memory serves you well,
these songs were released years later as The Basement Tapes. They revealed an embryonic stage of what would become The Band. Last fall, the band's drummer Levon Helm published his autobiography, This Wheel's on Fire. At the same time, Helm, along with former bandmates Rick Danko and Garth Hudson, put out a new album called Jericho. Terry Gross spoke with Levon Helm in November. He told her about that first tour with Dylan in 1965. Dylan had been booed at the Newport Folk Festival when he came out with his electric guitar. The band became Dylan's electric backup band. Terry asked Levon Helm if Dylan gave them any advice at their first gig about what to do if the crowd got hostile.
He told us, we had a little huddle there backstage before we went on for the second half. He played the first half by himself, and it went just smooth as silk, and the crowd loved it. And the second half, we huddled, and we knew. We had read and heard about, things getting a little bit tough in Newport. He told us, whatever happens, don't stop playing. Just keep playing and give it a chance to settle down. And we did, and I don't know if it ever settled or not.
You left the band shortly after it became Dylan's backup band. Why did you leave it? I mean, this was like, in retrospect, a great opportunity for the group.
Well, it was, and, I probably could have been smarter about it, but we had played most of the American part of the tour. Bob wanted to play Europe. He wanted to go to Australia, and so we played through the Northeast, which was pretty tough. Towns like Boston, they gave us a standing ovation of boos, and at the same time, we would hit Fort Worth, Texas, and it would be just another good rock and roll party. But it started wearing on me. I got to the point where I couldn't find enough funny things to laugh about it. I didn't feel like joking around all the time like I usually do, and I decided that maybe I should let the tour go ahead to Europe and to Australia and some foreign places without running the risk of making a monkey out of myself. So I stayed back and waited on everybody. I went back to Arkansas and played with the Cate Brothers band and kind of picked up where I'd left off playing dances and so forth.
So you rejoined the band after the band moved to the Catskills, which was after Bob Dylan's motorcycle accident.
Yes, ma'am. He had a bike, spilled his bike after they got back, so it kind of changed directions, and instead of so much touring, there was a lot of extra time, to put music together. And Garth set up his Ampex tape machine in the basement there at Big Pink, and we started getting together and just putting songs together and trying our voices, finding out how to stack our harmonies and just things like that that helped us out later on.
Well, you write in your book that you think this song, Ain't No More Cain, which is actually recorded on the Basement tapes, was a real breakthrough for the group. What did you think was a breakthrough about it?
Probably the voices. That's when we first started swapping the lead vocals around. We would trade verses, and we found out a couple of different ways to stack the harmonies and the answers up with the lead vocals. So that helped us a lot as far as finding out, the different possibilities for our voices.
Well, let's hear Ain't No More Cain from the Basement tapes.
All right.
Ain't no more Cain.
That's the band, and my guest is Levon Helm, who's co-authored a new book called This Wheel's on Fire, Levon Helm and the Story of the Band. The band also has a new record called Jericho. So when you moved to the Catskills, and the band was living in a house that was pink and was nicknamed Big Pink, did you move into the house with them?
Yes, I did. Moved into the house there. There was an extra spot for me, and we used it as our headquarters and music room for a couple of 3 years there.
So after recording in the basement, you finally got to record an album. The album was The Big Pink, your first album, but the band's name was not initially supposed to be The Band. What was it supposed to be, and how did you end up with the name The Band?
We didn't know what it was supposed to be, and we had signed an agreement with Capitol Records. Well, it hadn't come to that yet. We were trying to sign an agreement, and we ended up signing the agreement as the Crackers, and we thought that was funny. Nobody else did, especially the record company.
Was the joke that everybody except you was from the North?
Well, that, we tried the Honkies just for variety, and they didn't think that was too funny either. People referred to us as the Band. Bob's at the hotel, and the band is headed for the sound check. So on the Big Pink record, when it came time for the credits to list everybody's names, I think it said something like The Band, and then underneath it, it told you who all was in the band. So when we cut our second record, the record company kind of shifted that back around, and they liked that better than the Crackers.
Levon Helm is my guest. When did things start going bad for the band, within the band? Dissension and things like that. I mean, for example, you write in the book about how really annoyed you were when you'd see on records that Robbie Robertson had all the songwriting, or most of the songwriting credits.
Well, that was a bit of a distraction. I didn't think it was quite fair. Not that Robbie didn't do a lot of the songwriting, most of it in some spots, but at the same time, Richard did some good work, and I always thought that that Garth and Rick and myself was there all the way, no matter whose idea the song was, or if it was halfway there, or it was finished. Most of our stuff then got finished under that workshop kind of circumstance, and that was just one of the things that came up that kind of created a little bit of tension in the group. I could see it, hampering our collaboration, and It started bothering the spirit of it.
Robbie Robertson, in I guess it was 76, decided he wanted to leave the band and that the band should break up and have this big finale concert and go out with a real bang. You didn't want the band to break up, so you tried to resist that, but I guess you weren't able to.
Well, I wasn't. By then, maybe the last waltz started back, you know, during some of the disenchantment that I felt when the songs didn't reflect what I thought was the true spirit of things. So by the time the last waltz came up, it was no secret our collaboration and I thought that the quality of our music had suffered. I didn't hear us getting better. I heard us, doing albums with old songs that we liked as opposed to getting in and really trying to grow a fresh crop of songs. And I certainly didn't want to end the band. The last waltz, didn't set right with me. But, you know, there comes a time when we all want to move on, and that's what we did.
Martin Scorsese directed the film The Last Waltz, the film of the last concert performance in which there were lots and lots of guest stars. Did you like the film?
I liked some parts of it. Overall, I didn't like it a whole lot because I felt that some of the best songs and some of the best moments were still on the cutting room floor.
Now, the band reunited in 83, but just a few years after that, Richard Manuel hung himself. Were you shocked by that? Did you see it coming at all?
You know, it's hard to see trouble coming. At the time, I thought we were doing pretty well. We didn't have a recording contract, and there didn't seem to be one available for us. And what kept us going was when we played for the people. When we played music, everybody liked it, and we never had anybody ask for their money back. And I thought we were still sounding good, and we were evolving. It was painful. But I didn't think it was as painful as that, and I certainly didn't see it coming.
Did you think about him a lot when putting together the new record?
Yes, we did, because we had Country Boy, which was the last song that Richard recorded with the band, and it was a great tune, a great performance on Richard's part, and we were never able to get it finished and to finish the other songs that needed to go with it to make up a whole album. So it didn't get to come out when we thought it would, and when we finally managed to put the rest of the songs for Jericho together, I don't think it occurred to any of us not to use Richard's song.
That's Levon Helm of the band speaking with Terry Gross. This is from Jericho, the band's release last year with Levon Helm, Rick Danko, and Garth Hudson. One track features an old recording of the late Richard Manuel singing Country Boy. This is Fresh Air.
Never gonna kiss those ruby red lips of the sweetest girl in town. I'm never gonna ask her if she'll marry me, 'cause I know she'll turn me down. Because I'm just a country boy, and money have I none. Oh, but I've got silver in the stars, gold in the morning.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
From Philadelphia, this is Fresh Air. Before David Crosby and Graham Nash came together to form Crosby, Stills, and Nash, they had separate music careers with the Byrds and the Hollies. Coming up on this archive edition of Fresh Air, David Crosby and Graham Nash talk about what led to their musical collaboration and their long-standing friendship. And film critic Stephen Schiff reviews the new movie about three drag queens touring the wilds of Australia, The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert. That's all coming up on today's archive edition of Fresh Air.
From National Public Radio in Washington, I'm Barbara Campbell. President Clinton sent cabinet members and top White House officials to Capitol Hill today to lobby lawmakers to get the crime bill passed and to vote on a health care reform plan. Mr. Clinton has said he will insist on a bill that ensures life insurance coverage, or rather health insurance coverage, for at least 95% of Americans. Health Secretary Donna Shalala says the president's troops are ready for a strong effort on health care.
I would describe them as riled up and enthusiastic about first going to the Hill this morning with a message to the Senate about the Mitchell health care bill and the necessity of getting universal coverage and passing the health care bill this year, and in particular for the Senate to act as soon as possible, and that means beginning the votes next week. We're obviously very pleased with the debates that have taken place.
The House is delaying action on health care for at least a week. Democratic leaders say they need time to look at cost estimates for different plans. Major League Baseball team owners and players are meeting in New York for contract talks. The players walked off the job last night over a dispute involving salaries. NPR's Jim Zaroli reports.
The baseball season came to an abrupt halt last night, the game's eighth work stoppage in more than two decades. The strike shows every sign of being a long one. The two sides are at an impasse over whether a cap should be placed on player salaries. Team owners say the rise in salaries is destroying the competitive balance among teams. But players are refusing to consider a cap until team owners open up their books and prove they're in financial distress. The two sides agreed to meet today, but the last few bargaining sessions have produced nothing but an escalation in rhetoric. Many observers say the players may stay off the job for weeks. By doing so, they would deny team owners the revenues from postseason TV games, and that could give them more leverage in contract talks. In New York, this is Jim Zaroli reporting.
In another breach of the peace agreement around Sarajevo, the Bosnian Serbs seized a heavy cannon today from a UN storage depot, but they returned it at the demand of UN peacekeepers. The last time the Serbs took back some of their heavy weapons, the UN called in an airstrike by NATO warplanes. The UN says its job of restoring order in the area is made harder by the offensive by the Muslim-led Bosnian army just north of Sarajevo. Fighting there eased today, and the flow of government troops into the region decreased. The government says consumer prices rose 0.3 points in July, but the overall inflation rate so far this year is just 2.7% at an annual rate. On Wall Street today, stock prices closed higher. The Dow Jones Industrial Average gained almost 18 points to close at 3768.71. Advances led declines by a margin of 4-3 in heavy trading. This is NPR News. Reporters will not be able to have a look at the photographs of murder victims Nicole Simpson and Ronald Goldman. The judges ruled in Los Angeles that news stories about the pictures would be, in his words, graphic and lurid, and could influence potential jurors in the murder case against O.J. Simpson. Judge Lance Ito is allowing reporters to see photographs of some of the items from the crime scene, including a bloody glove and shoe prints. The Internal Revenue Service has clarified the deductibility of some club dues. NPR's Greg Peppers reports.
The IRS's proposed regulation would continue to allow taxpayers to deduct dues to clubs so long as the principal purpose of the club is public service rather than recreation or entertainment. In addition, taxpayers would have to continue to show they derive a business benefit from their membership. A Treasury Department official offered this example of the proposed regulation. If you're a Rotary Club member but all the club does is have a swimming pool and run a bowling outing, you can't deduct the dues. Regulations also would clarify that dues continue to be deductible for groups similar to professional organizations, such as business leagues, trade associations, chambers of commerce, and real estate boards. The deductibility of such dues had been in doubt since last August when Congress passed a budget act, including a provision disallowing the deduction of dues to clubs organized for social purposes. Prior to the law, most social club dues had been deductible so long as the taxpayer derived a business benefit from membership. The proposed rules will be issued in their final form following public hearings in November. I'm Greg Peppers in Washington.
Environmentalist Richard Leakey says foreign tourists can save Africa's endangered animals by spending money on the continent. Leakey said today that African governments can't afford wildlife preservation efforts without tourist revenue. Leakey used to head Kenya's wildlife department, and he says that since 1990, Kenya has used tourist dollars to save the elephant herds. I'm Barbara Campbell, NPR News in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. Another tape we found in our Woodstock archives was a 1990 interview Terry Gross did with David Crosby and Graham Nash. In 1968, David Crosby of the Byrds, Stephen Stills of the Buffalo Springfield, and Graham Nash of the Hollies formed a new group. Crosby, Stills, and Nash, sometimes joined by Neil Young, was one of the most popular groups of the late 60s and early 70s. They've performed together on and off since that time. Their signature is their close harmonies.
One morning I woke up and I knew you were gone. A new day, a new way, and new eyes to see the dawn. Go your way, I'll go mine, get gone.
I want to ask you about the harmonies that you do. I think, like, voices, as you get older, your voice change tends to deepen a little bit. Has
yes.
that affected, like, where you each sing in the harmonies now or the way you lay out the harmonies?
Not so much how we lay them out. You know, we might not be, you know, by a couple of notes, we might not be quite as ambitious as we were, but Graham has somehow magically retained his ability to sing stratospherically high. And he does so consistently. So the top end of our sound has remained pretty much the same. I've lost a couple of notes with age, but not too many. And I usually sing the middle part, so it's not really a problem. And Stephen, although he has a falsetto where he can go up pretty high, usually sings the lower part. And we haven't had to compromise much.
Let me play something from the new record. And Graham, I want to play one of your songs. This is House of Broken Dreams.
Yes.
And I'm wondering if you think of this as a kind of follow-up to Our House.
I didn't until somebody pointed out that it could be the antithesis of that song.
Yeah.
And when I began to look at it from that point of view, I kind of agree with them. It, you know, Our House has a very rosy future, and House of Broken Dreams has a very dusty end.
Let's listen to it.
Living in a house of broken dreams, where shadows throw shadows on the wall, and memories are mountains to climb, knowing everyone can fall. And here, where the cobwebs count the hours, since we let the laughter clear the air, painfully trying to touch, knowing that we used to care. Separate houses, face the feelings tearing us apart. In this house of broken dreams, love lies.
House of Broken Dreams, written by Graham Nash from the new Crosby, Stills, and Nash album called Live It Up. The new record is on Atlantic?
Always.
Yeah, well, I had read somewhere, you could tell me this is true, that if this is true, that you're still fulfilling the initial contract to Atlantic Records because you never made as many records as it stipulated in the contract.
We'll probably be fulfilling the initial contract to Atlantic sometime in the year 2000.
And the reason why we are with Atlantic is that we have tremendous loyalty to Ahmet Erdogan and Doug Morris. Ahmet has been the man that we signed with in 1969 for mm-hmm. six records, which we still have not completed yet. We believe that Ahmet Erdogan is one of the true music people within the music business, a business that has been overrun by lawyers.
But so you still are fulfilling that initial contract in a way,
well,
right?
Actually, we've rewritten that contract several times since then. So not in technical fact, no, we're not. But in, you know, in a certain sense, yes, we are. And we will probably continue to be. We really, Ahmet's a friend.
Yeah.
He's not, you know, somebody that normally my you know, relationship with record companies would be as an adversary, mm-hmm. you know, but Ahmet's a friend.
Is that one of the things that keeps the group together, or is it far beyond that?
It's only one very simple thing that keeps this band together, and that's music. I think that if we didn't make music together, I probably wouldn't speak to Stephen. I would speak to David. He lives 20 seconds away from me. We have breakfast most mornings and hang out. Stephen lives miles away from me. And if we didn't make music, I probably would not maintain my relationship with Stephen. I love him dearly. I love to make music with him. But he can be difficult.
Well, I get the feeling in your own ways, maybe you're all difficult or something. I mean,
I'm sure we are. I'm sure, you know, if you were to ask Stephen,
yeah.
he would probably respond in kind. But what we have learned to do over the years is to be more cognizant of each other's feelings, more compassionate, more cognizant of our weaknesses and our strengths.
David Crosby, I want to play one of the songs that you wrote for the new album, Live It Up. Would you rather hear Arrows or Yours and Mine? I'm going to leave this one up to you.
Oh, what a terrible choice. I love Arrows because Michael Hedges, and you know who Michael Hedges is, right? He's a wonderful talent, wrote it together. But if I have to choose between the two, let's do Yours and Mine because I think it's about something really important.
You want to say anything about writing it?
I'll tell you how it happened. It was a very good example of helping a song grow. You saw Time magazine a couple of weeks ago, right?
The kid. What was the cover?
The kid with the automatic rifle. 14-year-old boy on the cover with a Colt Armalite rifle. I've seen pictures like that before, and somehow that stuck in my mind as just, you know, a perfect example of wrong. You know, I know that we did something wrong in this world when that kid is standing there with that rifle, you know, and kids younger than that are dying every day in Beirut and in Belfast and even in L.A.
Well, let's hear it.
I can see a boy at 14. He's got a rifle in his hand. He's dying to defend his desert land. He's got an arm around his father, another arm around his gun. Must the child and father die so young? There's a teenage girl in Belfast playing in the street. Her brother plays a different game, and he's turning up the heat on the soldiers around the corner and the powers overseas. And who are they to ruin lives like these?
Cause they are us. And they're mine, they're yours and mine. Cause they're yours, and they're mine, yours and mine.
David Crosby and Graham Nash speaking with Terry Gross in a 1990 interview. We'll be back in a few moments. This is Fresh Air. We continue with the archive interview which Terry Gross had with David Crosby and Graham Nash.
I'd really love to hear the story about how the two of you first met. Is there such a story?
Yes, there is, yeah.
Can you tell it?
The Hollies were in Los Angeles in 1967, maybe even late 66. And I had, on a previous visit, met a woman who drastically changed my life. Her name was Cass Elliott. She was the lead singer with Mamas and the Papas. And on my next visit to L.A., when I was staying at the Knickerbocker, she called me up one day. She said, I want to take you somewhere. Be downstairs in the lobby 5 minutes. Which is the way the cast used to operate the world, you know. Be here, be here, be here, be here, be here, be here. So I was down in the lobby, and she roared up in this red convertible Porsche and proceeded to drive me up Laurel Canyon. And windy, 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 and we end up at this house that also has a dark green Porsche. Was it convertible, David?
No.
No, a dark green Porsche in the garage. Led me up the stairs, and I see this man who is lying on a settee with a tray of dope on his chest.
Well, let's be specific now. It was a tray of...
Marijuana,
at the time.
Yeah, that's what we called dope then, in those days. Rolling the most immaculate joints that I've ever seen. That could very well have easily gone into a packet and been sold as, you know, consumer-level stuff. And that kind of amazed me because I'd never seen anybody quite do this whilst answering the phone, whilst watching the TV and reading a book at the same time.
Eating too, probably.
Yes, probably. We got on famously. David did not know who I was.
But Cass the Rat didn't tell me who he was.
Was that intentional?
Yeah, sure. She loved to do things like that. She didn't tell me who he was. I really liked this guy, you know, that she brought over. He was totally mystified about who he was. I hadn't the vaguest clue. And then after he was gone, you know, later on, I said, well, who was that guy? And she said, you ever hear King Midas in reverse? And I said, you're kidding, you know. I'm a harmony singer freak. You know, I love harmony singers. You know, I love the Everly Brothers. I love people that can sing great harmony. And the minute you hear a Hollies record, you know, that's what you notice is this fantastic high harmony. And so she told me, I beat her about the head and shoulders for a while and said, I want to see him again.
And that's how David and I met.
So how did you decide to actually perform together?
Well, we were friends before we ever got involved in music on that level. We both, of course, knew each other musically, and I was a great fan of his stuff on the Byrds albums. And one day the Byrds were touring England, and David was in London, and I had his number, and he was staying at a hotel that was, strangely enough, called the White House. And I said, hey, you don't want to be at the White House. Blue-haired ladies, old people, cigars,
pit.
Come over and stay with me. So he came over to stay with me at my, I had a Muse apartment in London. And then we started to talk music, you know, and he left me with a tape of a very early demo of a song he'd written called Guinevere, and a song he'd written called Deja Vu, and a song he'd written called Wooden Ships. I believe Long Time Gone was on that also. And so, it amazed me that these songs had not been recorded yet. Because, you know, in hindsight, they were brilliant songs. From the very first musical inklings of this man, of this mass complex man that Crosby is, I began to realize that I would like to make music with this man, that he wrote and thought very differently than me. And yet there was something that bound us together, either our sense of humor or our sense of the ridiculous or our... sense of rebellion. There was something that linked David and I together from the very beginning, and it remains to this day.
Were there things you wanted to each do that you couldn't do with the bands that you were with, that Graham Nash you couldn't do with the Hollies?
Obviously.
That David Crosby you couldn't do with the Byrds?
Yeah. I'm not as sure now as I was then that I was being held back by the situation I was in, but I was certainly stuck in a role. I was, you know, the rhythm guitar player, harmony singer, and it was tough for me to be recognized as a singer-songwriter in my own right in that band and in that role. And I know that it was even more so for Graham. Graham was writing songs that absolutely stunned me. They were so good. And his band wanted to do an album of Dylan songs. And
Which is not necessarily bad, but they wanted to do it Las Vegas style.
Well, no, I really think actually the Hollies doing Dylan is like, yeah. really inappropriate
I'm
choice.
I'm trying to be kind.
I'm trying to be kind, too.
Well, the Hollies has such great records. I mean, like I'm sorry.
They make great records. Yeah. But a Dylan song is not the thing for them to be doing. Not at all. Not even close. Not in the ballpark. And they had great songs, his songs. So I know that he was, you know, frustrated, too. And then my relationship with the Byrds came to, a feisty end between me and them, and they threw me out. And I started hanging around with Steven. And then we, you know, lucked into, you know, singing together. And the minute you sing together and hear that sound, you know you want to do that, obviously.
Now, I want to get back, Graham Nash, to your work with the Hollies. Now, you were writing, I mean, what I think was, like, great songs like Stop, Stop, Stop and Carrie Ann. I mean, did you feel like that was a kind of pop that you didn't want to do anymore?
It became so after a while. You know, we were trained to write, you know. I don't think we ever wrote anything over 2 minutes and 50 seconds long.
Mm-hmm.
You know, there was a Tin Pan Alley kind of training that we went through in the late 50s, early 60s. And that's what I was kind of stuck in. But then having met David and Steven and expanded my awareness, not only on a personal level, but on by smoking huge, copious amounts of marijuana, I began to change the way I felt about what was important in music. And I began to realize that the three-minute pop song, although it has its value, was not truly, truly important on a deep level. And so I began to write songs that I personally thought that were better songs than just three-minute pop songs. And Hollies were not interested in those songs. And so I began to question myself. I thought that it was me that was at fault, that I was wrong, that, you know, because there were four of them and only one of me. It was Crosby that saved my musical life by saying, wait a second, if you're crazy, then I'm just as crazy. And maybe we should stick together here.
That was Graham Nash and David Crosby speaking with Terry Gross back in 1990. This is Only Waiting for You from their new album, After the Storm.
Really only waiting for you. What do you suppose that we can do?
This is Fresh Air. Noah Adams has joined us to tell us about All Things Considered today. Noah, what stories do you have for us?
Hi, Marty. Day after reaction to the vote against the crime bill here in Washington, Linda Wertheimer talks with Mara Liasson and Elizabeth Arnold. Mandalay Del Barco reports about the beating by police of a Latino teenager in Compton, California, and the reaction in that community. It was a videotaped beating. Also, Martha Raddatz reports on U.S. military readiness around the world should several conflicts break out at once. Bob Mondello has a review of the new film A La Mode and some thoughts on a summertime 50 years ago exactly, written by E.B. White, and the Reduced Shakespeare Company on Woodstock 94.
Thanks, Noah. Those stories and more later today on All Things Considered from National Public Radio. The Australian director Stephen Elliott will be 31 at the end of the month, by which time his life may well have changed. His first feature, Frauds, played at the Cannes Film Festival in 1993, but then never got U.S. distribution. Now his new film is opening gradually across America. Film critic Stephen Schiff has this review of The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert.
Priscilla isn't a person, she's a bus. And her purpose in life is to transport three drag queens from Sydney across the great Australian desert to the outback town of Alice Springs, where the three will perform in a fancy resort hotel. The one who's actually got the gig is Teak, also known as Mitzi, and played very well by Hugo Weaving, whom you may remember from the movie Proof. He recruits his flamboyant co-star, Adam, also known as Felicia, and played by Guy Pearce, and then he needs one more. So he seeks out Bernadette, a transsexual and something of a living legend on the drag circuit. He, or she, is played by Terrence Stamp with a dignified gravity worthy of Garbo. Teak finds Bernadette at a funeral where she is mourning the loss of her latest lover, known only as Trumpet.
It's not fair.
I spent half my life and all my savings trying to snag a sympathetic husband. Selfish little goes and dies on me.
25 years old. He goes and slips over in a bathroom.
He didn't slip. He's peroxiding his hair at home again. He asphyxiated on the fumes.
I've been asked to do a show out of town.
That's nice.
Well, why don't you come with me? I'll need some help, and I think we could both use the break.
You're not wrong. Where is it?
Alice Springs?
You've got to be joking.
Just this once, he's not joking, but most of the time, the film is. Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is basically a road movie with gags. Lots of double entendres. Lots of mincing and lisping. And lots of shots of our boys in some godforsaken mining town prancing around in feathers and fishnets while burly goons watch them bug-eyed. Along the way, we find out about our heroes' pasts, we watch them resolve their disputes and come to terms with who they are, and we build to a happy ending in Alice Springs that's soppy enough to make It's a Wonderful Life look like film noir. The Australian cinema is still tiny, but certain pockets of it have become awfully slick. Last year's Strictly Ballroom was as shameless a heart-tugger as anything Hollywood has ever produced. And Priscilla, Queen of the Desert, is just as smooth and calculated. It's a crowd-pleaser. And like La Cage aux Folles before it, it could be a sizable hit, even with audiences that are otherwise indifferent to the sight of boys lip-syncing to disco tunes while wearing dresses made entirely out of rubber beach thongs. The costumes in this movie are genuinely funny, and so are the gags. And there's also something winning about the movie's lack of pretense. True, there are a few sequences in which shots of our heroes out in the middle of nowhere, dressed in their finery, are intercut with spectacularly colorful desert lizards, as if to say that all this artifice is in some way part of nature's plan. But still, no one here is pretending that these drag queens are great talents and that their art form is deathless and underappreciated. All this movie asks of the audience is that it try to understand one thing. That to some people, climbing to the top of Australia's magnificent Kings Canyon and looking out over the empty vastness beyond is not quite as thrilling as climbing to the top of Kings Canyon and looking out over the empty vastness beyond in sequins, a tiara, and 4-inch heels.
Stephen Schiff is critic at large for The New Yorker. The Adventures of Priscilla, Queen of the Desert is now opening in New York, Los Angeles, San Francisco, and Seattle. It opens wider August 26th. Fresh Air's senior producer this week is Fred Landrell. Our technical director is Audrey Bentham. Dorothy Farabee is our administrative assistant. Our intern is Abby Beshkin. For Terry Gross, I'm Marty Moscowane.
Support for Fresh Air comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
The ethnic violence that has shaken Rwanda is spilling over into Burundi. On the next Fresh Air, we talk with Susan Walker of Physicians for Human Rights about the looming crisis in Burundi. She just returned from a 3-week trip there. I'm Marty Moscowane, and I hope you'll join us for the next Fresh Air.